Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning on the court's oral submission docket are three causes that have been consolidated into one argument. The causes are Robert and Tony M. Stat and others versus United States Brass Corporation, United States Brass Corporation and others versus Emory H. and Susan Pucci and others, and United States Brass Corporation and others versus Nabil Andrus and others. All of these are from Harris County. The court has arranged the arguments into petitioners and respondents and has allotted 30 minutes for each side to present argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded for the court, and if you desire to listen to or purchase a tape of the argument, you may do so by making application with our clerk. The court is ready to hear argument in these cases.
May it please the court, Ms. Marie Yates will present argument for petitioner Michelle Oil Company, and Mr. Hector Torres will present argument for petitioner Kirk Selmy Corporation. Ms. Yates will speak for 15 minutes, and Mr. Torres will speak for 5 minutes. Petitioners also reserve 10 minutes for their rebuttal.
May it please the court. Your Honors, Mr. Powers will do the rebuttal for the petitioners.
Ms. Yates, before we start on your time, can you speak to the motion to dismiss the appeal based on settlement? Clarify that for me.
I certainly can.
At least give me your perspective as to why we're here if the case has been settled.
The motion, of course, has been withdrawn by the plaintiffs last week. It was withdrawn after it was filed.
Are the parties about $25,000 apart?
There is a provision in the settlement agreement pursuant to which, depending on how this appeal comes out, there's another amount of money, and I believe, Your Honor, it may be $50,000 that would change hands depending on the outcome of the appeal. The settlement agreement was postured intentionally to permit this case to be argued because it's the interest of both parties to get it decided. And under your Ruiz versus Consul decision, a very similar settlement agreement was at issue, and the court said that appellate issue was not moved. Your Honors, the issue in these consolidated BTPA cases is not whether the plaintiffs in this case who bought these homes, the purchasers of the homes on our chart, are consumers. These plaintiffs are, of course, consumers with respect to their consumer transaction in which they purchased their homes from the home builder. In the chart, it's General Homes. The consumer transaction for purposes of the DTPA is therefore the red circle transaction where the consumer purchases his or her home from General Homes on the poster. The issue before this court is whether or not these petitioners, Shell, U.S. Brass, and Selmy, who are upstream from the consumer transaction, who are suppliers of materials and component parts that go into the house, who are alleged to have made misrepresentations upstream of the consumer transaction, upstream, that the consumer never heard, that the consumer was not aware of, whether these type of upstream defendants can be defendants who are liable under the DTPA. Now, Your Honors, we are not asking the court to rewrite the statute. This court stated in the Flanagan opinion, which is one of your decisions, which is listed on our chart here, this court stated in Flanagan that the statute does not define who can be a defendant. The statute does not define. And therefore, in this series of cases, Your Honors have held, one, the defendant does not have to be in contractual privity. And we are not here today arguing that the defendant has to be in contractual privity. But what Your Honors have held, what this court has held in this series of cases, is that the defendant, while privity is not required, the defendant's deceptive act, the defendant's violation of the DTPA, must have been done in connection with, or connected with, or in the context of, or during, occurring in connection with the consumer transaction. And our position here is that you have never held, this court has never held, that an upstream supplier of component parts or raw materials whose representations never were heard by the consumer is somebody who is in connection with the consumer transaction. And this is your rule, not our rule. We're not asking the court to engraft some new rule on the DTPA. This is the rule that this court has already recognized. What we are asking this court to do is stick with the law that you've already written. And what you've said On every one of these cases, the defendant has injected itself into the red circle, into the consumer transaction. In Cameron, the first case on the chart, the real estate agent goes into the consumer transaction and makes a representation to the consumer. In Flinnikin, the creditor bank is the trustee on the deed of trust that the consumer signs. And as your honors wrote, or as the court wrote in that opinion, the creditor in Flinnikin was exercising the seller's rights when the bank creditor foreclosed on the consumer's house. These upstream suppliers, in this case, of raw materials and component parts, are not exercising any rights of the seller. They did not inject themselves into the consumer transaction. They did not make any misrepresentation that was heard or aware that the consumers were even aware of. Now, the rule that the plaintiffs want your honors to adopt is a rule where you step away from what you've already written and you say, okay, we're going to eliminate, we're going to abandon our in connection with requirement and say it doesn't matter whether your representation was made in connection with the consumer transaction. It's not going to matter anymore. And that's a slippery slope, your honors, because if that's the case, then the example that I would give you is that the polybutylene business in this case, the making of these chemicals, was sold to Shell by Whitco and was bought from Whitco from Mobil. And if the plaintiffs were right and had Mobil made some representation when it sold the polybutylene business to Whitco that, hey, this stuff is good to make plumbing systems, the plaintiffs could sue on that misrepresentation. So the purchaser could come all the way up the chain and get Whitco. And that's never been what your honors have held. You've always said no privity, but the defendant's conduct must be in connection with. And actually, the very fact situation that we have here today, interestingly enough, has already been decided by the Austin Court of Appeals in a case that came up to this court, Southwestern Bell Telephone versus Boyce Ironworks. Because in that case, the telephone company, an upstream supplier of telephone services for the alarm system, had made representations to the PUC. And had the telephone company not made those representations to the PUC, the phone lines never would have been used. Just like the plaintiffs say, if Shell had not made representations to the code bodies, in this case, the plumbing systems never would have been in the houses. But the Austin Court of Appeals said, what is the consumer transaction? The first sentence in the significant paragraph in Judge Shannon's opinion, what is the consumer transaction? And he identifies the consumer transaction as the purchase of the alarm system. Now, he could have decided that case on in connection with, but instead he decided on producing cause. And I'm here today, Your Honors, to tell you that you can decide our case on your in connection with rule or on producing cause.
How about Weitzel versus Bonds?
That's a very good question, Your Honor. What Weitzel did not involve a situation where the plaintiff, consumer, did not hear the representation. In Weitzel, you'll recall, Your Honor, the plaintiff heard the consumer transaction. And I would say, Your Honor, that this case straight up presents the issue that Justice Gonzalez, you wrote on in your dissenting opinion in Weitzel, and that Justice Enoch picked up on his concurring opinion last year in Celtic Life, which is not whether reliance is an element of the cause of action on which you charge the jury. And that was the issue in Celtic Life. Do you charge the jury on reliance? No. The statute says producing cause is the element of the cause of action. But what Your Honor, Justice Gonzalez said in Weitzel is, we still have to know what does producing cause mean.
Is there a difference between reliance and producing cause?
Your Honor, I believe there can be. And this is, after all, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Now, and you, Your Honors, have never written that a representation that the plaintiff consumer never hears can be a producing cause. You've never said that. In Weitzel, the plaintiff heard the representation. Okay? In Celtic Life, the plaintiff most certainly heard the representation. You've never said that somebody that didn't hear it and wasn't deceived could still prove producing cause. And that's what Justice Gonzalez was writing about in Weitzel. What is legally sufficient proof of producing cause in a misrepresentation case?
Why now, is it necessary to hear it in order for it to be in connection with the transaction? And what's the magic about the consumer hearing it?
It
as
may
long
not
as
be.
The representation led to the product being in the good which the consumer has, which is now
yes.
Created the problem.
Chief Justice Phillips, it may not be necessary. For example, some of our findings here are unconscionability findings. Flinnikin was an unconscionability case. And the court still said the DCPA violation has to be in connection with the consumer transaction. Now, it is difficult for me to imagine how in a misrepresentation context the plaintiff could prove in connection with without the misrepresentation reaching the consumer. But my point is that this court could go off, if you wanted to, in either way in this opinion. You could write an opinion that says it's not in connection with.
Well, let me just back up. I'll make my question clear. You see a factual pattern of similarity in these cases that have set up this test, which
yes.
You seem to have stated a little differently. But is there any language in these cases that says that the consumer hearing the representation or being directly in the transaction, in the very transaction itself, which is unconscionable on the part of one of the defendants, is necessary in order to meet these tests as we've articulated? Or is this just something you're gathering out of the fact pattern?
The language of the cases does not go, or your case, does not go off on whether the consumer heard it. But what it does say is that the DTPA violation must be in connection with. And the test that I'm drawing from your cases is, because that's the fact pattern in every one of them, the defendant has injected itself into the consumer transaction, has been involved in that transaction in some fashion, has dealt with the plaintiff, has interfaced with the plaintiff, or has stood in the shoes of the seller in some fashion as in Flinkin.
That's not invariably a lock-off in terms of the badness of the conduct, if it were.
It may not be in with respect to all types of recovery, all types of liability, but I'm just talking about the DTPA. And the statute is the Consumer Protection Act, and you have said that who is a consumer is defined not in terms of the relationship of the parties, but in relationship to the transaction. And all we're saying here is that you've also said that who is a defendant is defined in terms of the relationship to the transaction. Now, I don't believe, if I could get back to producing cause just for a second, I don't believe that this is inconsistent with Weitzel, and to back to Justice Cornyn's question, with Weitzel or Celtic. Because all you said in Weitzel and Celtic is it's not an element of the cause of action, and in Celtic what you said specifically last year is you don't charge the jury on it. But that doesn't reach the issue here. The issue here is what is legally sufficient proof of producing cause in a misrepresentation case. And can you prove producing cause in a misrepresentation case where the consumer never heard the representation? And so that is a second and alternative way for this court to deal with this case. You could decide, my point is, on either one of two grounds. It could be because the representations up the chain are not in connection with the consumer transaction, or it could be because the representations that the consumer never hears can't possibly be legally sufficient proof of producing cause.
Why is it just more efficient to allow the consumer to assert a cause of action against the one who actually made the misrepresentation, even though they may be upstream, rather than require a lawsuit against their immediate seller, and then allow a succession of indemnity actions and things mm-hmm. like that to bring in about five different parties? Why shouldn't we allow just an action against the culprit and allow it to be hashed out in that
Consumer, of course, has an action against the culprit. If the culprit makes a misrepresentation that the consumer hears that's a producing cause of the consumer's transaction.
But here, if the sellers are merely conduits, I guess, of the product,
mm-hmm.
They're not actually consumers of the product, but the consumer's the first one who suffers a loss as a result of the misrepresentation. Why not the direct action?
Well, I would say, one, that that's inconsistent with what the court's already said. But two, to answer the policy question that Your Honor's asking, it provides no limitation on liability at all. In other words, if you don't limit it to the consumer transaction, then I get back to my WITCO example. It can be any misrepresentation up the chain. Because you see, the plaintiff's position here is that any representation, even in the Amstatt case, which is one of these three cases, it's undisputed that there were no representations to the home builder. That's what they're complaining about to this court at Amstatt, is even in the case where the home builder didn't even get any representations that caused it to put the plumbing systems in the houses, they think they should still be able to recover. Because in their view, there is no limitation. And in our view, there is a limitation on the deceptive trade practices statute, and it's the limitation you've repeatedly recognized who can be a defendant? Who can be a defendant is defined in terms of relationship to the transaction.
What remedy is the consumer left with under your...
The consumer can sue the seller or anybody else who's inextricably intertwined in the consumer transaction.
Even though the seller did not necessarily make a, immediate seller did not make a misrepresentation.
If he does, he can, of course. And then if the seller has received a misrepresentation from somebody up the stream, then in his consumer transaction, if he doesn't exceed the $25 million limitation under the DTPA to be a consumer, the seller has a claim over also. And I would like to point out, Your Honor, that we're not here reaching common law theories of liability. I mean, you know, if these plaintiffs could prove common law fraud or something against somebody up the stream, they're free to do that, but they can't. That's why they're trying to get there under the DTPA, because no misrepresentation that anybody on our side made was ever heard by the plaintiffs. And that's why they can't prove fraud. And we believe they shouldn't be able to prove a deceptive act when they weren't deceived. That nothing that we said deceived these home buyers, and therefore they should not be able to either prove in connection with, because there's nothing that we did that intentionally injected ourselves into the transaction, nor should they be able to prove producing cause.
Jeff, before you move on, was there also a negligence cause of action that's viable?
There is, Your Honor, and we have points of Arichelle does on the negligence theory, and on which
you're
Your
not
Honor,
conceding negligence.
That we, no, we're not conceding that. I know you didn't grant writ on that. We would say that an upstream supplier that whose misrepresentations, if any, were never heard by the consumer, can't possibly be a proximate cause of any damages to the consumer either.
About limitations, which are some defendants, some plaintiffs, right?
Right. Now, there's a statute of limitations issue with respect to some of the plaintiffs. Again, points of error that we didn't bring up, and I'm not really sure any of the petitioners brought up to that, but the plaintiffs may have. And with respect to some of the plaintiffs, they were properly denied a recovery because they had experienced leaks more than 2 years before they brought suit. And the court has said they should have brought suit early. And we think that's a proper result.
So you're saying that the people you represent are not liable under any theory?
No, Your Honor. Well, not under either negligence or the DTPA. Those are the theories that are here before you. And we feel strongly on the issue that Your Honor's granted writ on, that regardless of what you say about negligence, that we think we're right on negligence, that we do not believe that we could possibly be liable under the DTPA. And if I could just make one more point, that it would greatly expand the DTPA liability. If this court allows DTPA to now be extended to component part and raw material suppliers who make representations in the marketplace in order to generate an interest in their product, if we're going to do that and allow those kind of misrepresentations to be the basis of a DTPA cause of action, you've gone light years beyond where this court has been under the DTPA. And that's the one thought I'd like to leave you with, is that we are the ones that are asking you to follow what you've already written, and we believe the plaintiffs are asking you to change what you've already written.
Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
May it please the court, my name is Hector Torres. I'm here on behalf of Perks on East Corporation. I'd like to pick up on a point that Shell's counsel just raised at the end, and that is that contrary to the position of the respondents here, Salonese, at least, is in no way requesting that the court extend DTPA liability with respect to its existing law. And essentially what I'd like to state is that there has been no case from this court or any Texas state court where liability under the DTPA has been exposed on a raw material supplier who's far removed from the transaction, the consumer transaction that is the basis for the lawsuit, and who never made any representations whatsoever to the consumer. The Court of Appeals imposed DTPA liability on Salonese, which is a raw material supplier, based on a theory of inextricably intertwining. Now, just to clarify Salonese's role in this case, Salonese is a raw material supplier which was sold to U.S. Brass as one part of a component of the plumbing system that was ultimately incorporated into a home that was then sold to the consumer. Under the court's theory, the basis for finding DCPA liability against Celanese was the notion that Celanese was inextricably intertwined with General Holmes and the other defendants in the same way that the lender and the consumers were inextricably intertwined in the Knight case and in the Holland v. Mortgage versus Bohn decision. What I'd like to do is focus on those decisions and flesh out what exactly the courts found in those cases as far as inextricably intertwining. In the Knight decision, the court found that a lender was liable under the DCPA, although it was a non-privy defendant, because it was inextricably intertwined with the seller of the truck. And it was a case based on a violation of the contract had a provision which was unlawful, and that became the basis for the DCPA action, but the lender never had any relationship with the consumer. But the court found that the contract that was at issue had actually been drafted and supplied by the lender. There was a pre-printed clause in the contract which provided that it was to be assigned to the lender after it was executed. And all the contracts that the seller provided in connection with selling trucks in that business were provided essentially by the lender.
In contrast to Ms. Yates' argument, you're arguing the home buyers were not consumers?
Well, we're not arguing that home buyers were not consumers, but we're arguing that with respect to Celanese, the issue is the statute provides a definition of what the consumer is, and that's determined in relationship to the consumers or the plaintiff's relationship to the transaction. But what's open is what against which defendant can you impose this liability? And
well, are you arguing that there's no actionable, there's no liability under the DCPA, or are you arguing that they're not consumers relative to your client?
Well, we're arguing,
are you arguing
that
both?
It may be the same way of stating the point. I mean, the different ways of stating the same point, but what we're arguing is that with respect to Celanese, there can be no DCPA liability because this standard, which was applied by the court, which is that the parties were inextricably intertwined, is just not met here.
So they're not consumers?
As to Celanese. And
they may be at the shell, but not Celanese.
Pardon?
They may be at the shell, but not Celanese.
Well, it depends on how you define under the inextricably intertwined standard, it depends on how you define it. But one thing that's clear is if you look at the relationship of Celanese to General Holmes, you will not find that there is any connection there. Unlike the Knight case and unlike the Bohn case, there's no connection whatsoever between Celanese and General Holmes. Or if you look at the connection between Celanese and Shell or U.S. Brass, there is no connection that in any way even remotely resembles the connection that you had in the Knight case, which is really the only case out of this court where liability has been predicated on the inextricably intertwined theory. As to Brass, there is a relationship, obviously, but that relationship is an ordinary business relationship of a raw material supplier with a manufacturer.
Any other questions? Is 20 minutes expired?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Bryan will present arguments for respondents. He has 30 minutes.
May it please the court, I think the justices have already isolated the primary issue before you. Consumer law in this state has been well established since 1977 in the Woods versus Littleton decision, and the Cameron decision, and the Knight decision, and each one of the decisions that they've placed on the board before you. The only clear reading of those cases is that there are only two requirements to be a consumer under the DCPA. One must acquire by purchase, as in this case, goods, and those goods must be the subject of the complaint. No Supreme Court decision has ever embraced an in connection with requirement. You might wonder where counsel gets that language. Pull out your decision in Cameron. Yes, Your Honor.
Is there any case in Texas where a seller, I mean, where somebody, some supplier of materials to someone who manufactures a product and then sells it, has ever been found liable for, under the DTPA, for any of the acts enumerated in there or that they'd be liable for?
Yes, I think you'll find that Celotex opinion out of the Austin Court in 1993, where a Celotex, the remote supplier of shingles, who then distributed it through installers, distributors, and suppliers, was held liable in the DTPA to a condominium project. See, the factual underpinnings of this case are unique, and that's maybe why this case has gotten this court's attention. But the principles underlying this case are well-founded. To suggest that our argument is the one that deviates from your long-standing precedent and from legislative intent is to turn the argument on its head. Two requirements have been set forth in your opinion. Did we acquire the polybutylene system with the Celcon fitting? Did we acquire the polybutylene system marketed by Shell, sold and manufactured by U.S. Brass, undisputed in this record? Is the defective plumbing system the subject of the complaint, undisputed in this record? You heard Ms. Yates say, we're really not disputing that they're consumers. They have to make that argument because these two elements that
they're consumers as to General Homes or the builder or the whoever they purchased it from. They're consumers, but not as to this transaction that they're talking about, not as to Shell.
I see their argument as being a play on words. They are consumers with respect to the polybutylene plumbing system. But the Supreme Court, they say, has engrafted a requirement of in connection with. And nowhere in those opinions or in the legislative intent can you find words in connection with. Where they got it out of Cameron is most interesting. On page 541, it merely says that the act was designed to protect consumers from deceptive acts made in connection with the purchase of goods. That is base English language that meets the second component of the consumer test. That is, the representations must be about the goods which the consumer acquired. That is all that means. And then right after the court said that, the court said, to this end, we must give the act under the rule of liberal construction its most comprehensive application without doing any violence to its terms.
Isn't the act really designed to protect the consumer in transactions where the harm to an individual consumer may be something significant, but it doesn't want the seller, who's in a much better position to know the knowledge about their products, from misleading a consumer into buying a product that's obviously defective. Now, I mean, isn't that the nature of all this, and isn't it kind of a far afield to simply say, consumer, if you can find some advertisement somewhere down in the chain of back to the person who gets the raw materials, somewhere along the line, and that product ever fails, that you then have this protection because of the overreaching or something? I mean, if the policy behind it is to protect consumers in an overreaching transaction, how is this some sort of protection to the consumer that they're not influenced by any sort of representation?
You bring up a point that goes to the very heart of the DTPA and the public policy that mandates, in this case, you find consumer status. Look at what happens if you adopt petitioner's argument. Celanese, Shell, and U.S. Brass. Celanese produced the Celcon fitting that corroded, failed, and degraded when used in residential potable water. They tested this product. They worked with U.S. Brass in designing the system and ensuring that Celcon was the fitting that was used in the system. What you will see happen is suppliers of raw material, manufacturers of products, shift their responsibility for their wrongful acts and place those on retailers. In this case, if you accept their argument, the only party who is responsible under the DTPA is General Homes. General Homes received the same representation that they have made all the way down the chain.
So can't they collect from their seller?
Sure they can. And in this case, the jury found 30% responsibility to General Homes. But understand that within the confines of the DTPA, when you interpret it this way, it means that these parties who are wrongdoers, who knew their product was defective, who tested their product, who knew what it could do when it operated within a residential environment, they escaped liability. And why do they escape liability? Under an argument this court has never adopted, under an argument that flies in the face of the legislative intent of the Act, which is to give it its broadest and liberal application to protect consumers.
And you think that means that, to be clear, that any homeowner in these circumstances could sue any person who supplied something for the construction of the house that failed, either a good or a service that you claim was defective?
Absolutely.
And so I'll be clear on this. Could subsequent homeowners do that? For example, if A home owns the home for a while, sells it to B, B sells it to C, C sells it to D, all four of them actually can have lawsuits against the all of these suppliers.
Well, I think you're raising part of that issue brought by this court under the race judicata argument that if a claim is brought by one consumer and he makes a recovery, does that cut off claims of subsequent consumers?
And I understand your argument to be no.
Yes.
It does not cut them off.
But that's under a privity argument, which is a little bit separate issue, obviously, than the consumer status issue. But so we are clear. The law is that there are two requirements. The Act merely talks in terms of the class of persons who can bring suit. Once those two requirements are met, a party is a consumer. The issue then focuses, was there a misrepresentation? And was that representation a producing cause of damage?
Where's the producing cause under your scenario?
In this case...
If the ultimate consumer didn't hear the misrepresentation, how do they prove, but for misrepresentation, they would not have suffered damages?
This is my belief on what producing cause means. It does not mean that a party must hear the representation and rely on the representation. Albeit, in this case, there is evidence of reliance by General Homes in purchasing this system from U.S. Brass based on representations of U.S. Brass and Shell representatives.
Well, that helps U.S. Homes. That's their cause of action against Shell or Selenite, but how does that help your clients?
Well, because it is not necessary that my consumers be in contractual privity or that they purchase the goods directly from the wrongdoer. This court has held in Flanagan, in Cameron, and in all subsequent decisions, including Birchfield in 87, that we look in terms of the relationship to the overall transaction.
But it's got to be the producing cause of their damages, doesn't it?
No question. And the fact of the matter is, this plumbing system would not be in these people's homes, would not have caused the damage to these consumers, but for the representations made to General Homes to put it in there.
Mr. O'Brien, let me ask you a hypothetical question. Say I'm in the business of selling vacuum cleaners, and I'm looking to be a dealership for some manufacturer out there. And I go to various manufacturers, and they make various representations. One of them says, this vacuum cleaner really has an expected life of 15 years. Now, we're going to warranty it. We'll warranty it for 10. But we expect it to last about 15 years. And so the business owner says, well, this is the kind of vacuum cleaner that I want to sell to the public. And so they stock up and they sell it to the public, and the vacuum cleaner fails in 11 years. Now, they had a 10-year warranty on the vacuum cleaner, but it failed in 11 years. And so the consumer comes back to the seller of this and said, now I want to know any representation you had. Well, I bought it because they told me it would last 15 years. Now, would the vacuum cleaner buyer, the consumer, have a Deceptive Trade Practice Act against the original manufacturer of a vacuum cleaner because of that representation?
Sure, because the manufacturer in your scenario has made a representation to his retailer about the integrity of his product. He has said that my vacuum cleaner will last 15 years.
So in any business, so let's go back to your home. Any time that you have a manufacturer who uses parts supplied, virtually any one of them will have some sort of representation about the quality of that product as between, say, General Motors and, say, a supplier of radios. There will always be some discussion about the quality of the product. So if that product ever fails, then the ultimate consumer could always sue any supplier of any matter simply because the retailer of that product sold it on the market.
Well, if the product was defective and factually caused the damage to the consumer, yes. And that only makes sense. The standard under common law, under negligence and strict liability, where privity has been abolished, would provide such liability.
But you already have, the consumer already has a cause of action for defective products on the market. That's not this issue. The issue here is deceptive trade practices.
Correct.
Which is designed to meet a particular conduct in the marketplace, which is the overreaching of the seller to the buyer, the relative lack of bargaining power of the consumer who walks off the street to buy this vacuum cleaner, as opposed to the retailer who is buying lots of these vacuum cleaners and making a decision on which one to buy and which one not to buy. Why should DTPA extend to simple product defects that cause damage, as opposed to being taken out of the transaction that was designed to reach, which was the overreaching of a seller to a buyer and influencing them to buy a particular product?
I would say the public policy of the DTPA, as evidenced by the legislative intent, is contained in 17.44. To suggest that the legislature intended only to protect the consumer against the retailer and overreaching by the retailer does not pay homage to the liberal construction in 17.44, nor this court's decisions, which have rejected privity or any other similar requirement. This court has refused to inject requirements into the act unless the legislature has specifically placed them in the statute itself. And the only requirement to be a consumer under the DTPA are the twofold requirements this court has already indicated. The only requirement for producing cause has been that the representations were false and factually caused damage. Weisler versus Barnes, which has already been mentioned by the court, is a classic illustration. Admittedly, there's a difference of opinion about whether reliance is an element of producing cause. Logically should be an element of producing cause. I would say to the court that many times the evidence of reliance is used to establish producing cause. We see that often in the cases. But it is not an element of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. So says Weitzel. So says this court in Celtic. And to inject reliance as an element of the statute when it is clear that the legislature has not intended to do so, as interpreted by this court, is what they are asking you to do.
You said reliance will prove producing cause many times.
Many.
Can you explain the difference between producing cause and reliance?
Yes.
If there is any?
I see it as this fact. What the court recognized in Weitzel, that is, but for the falsity of the representation, the damage would not have occurred. Apply it to this case. The representation of the suitability of Celcon as being feasible and usable in this plumbing system were false. That is what the evidence was, is supported by the opinion of the jury, the trial court's judgment, and the Court of Appeals' opinion. The conduct of Shell in marketing the product, the conduct of U.S. Brass in representing that it would last over 25 years, that it was easy to install, that it wouldn't corrode. All these representations by the jury to be false. They were also found by the jury to be the cause of the damage, that the Celcon did corrode, that the system was not easy to install, that it would not last the lifetime of the home, then it would not last 26 years. It wouldn't last 5 years. In many cases, it didn't last a couple of years.
Are you arguing that that's different from reliance?
Yes, because it doesn't depend on whether someone heard or acted on it. It only depends on the fact that the representation was false and that what caused the damage. And that is that but-for test that doesn't depend on reliance that this court has discussed in Whitesville. Now, the fact of the matter is many cases go further in establishing that someone relied on these representations. It is clear and not subject to attack in this record that General Holmes relied on the representations of Shell and U.S. Brass in purchasing this system and putting it in the consumer's homes in Fairmont Park.
But how does that help your client?
It helps it.
If they did not rely on any representations to buy their home.
Because reliance, Justice Gonzales, is not a necessary element of...
We're talking about producing cause. How is that representation a producing cause of their damages?
If reliance is not necessary, if General Homes would not have put the home in, the plumbing system in their home, then they never would have suffered any damage. It doesn't matter that the consumer heard or had to act upon. General Homes purchased the system for their benefit, just like in Kennedy versus Sale when the company purchased the insurance policy for the benefit of the employee. That's why in Cameron, and always followed by this court has said you don't have to buy the goods directly from the defendant. You don't have to have privity. In this case, it is clear that if General Holmes did not rely on the representations of Shell, U.S. Brass, and if U.S. Brass had not relied on the representations of Celanese by Celcon, this system would not be in the homes of these consumers. They would not have suffered the damage that was found by the jury. Therefore...
Is it important to your argument that representations were made to General Holmes?
I think it is.
So if none had been made to General Holmes, then you would not have the same position.
I would have the same position, but I think as an evidentiary posture, again, reliance may help support producing cause. My position on producing cause is simple. But for the falsity of the representation, the damage factually would not have occurred.
Even if they had not been made to General Holmes?
Just that they were made. They would not have to have been heard by the consumer.
The manufacturer, the president turns to the vice president and says, I think this is good stuff, and that would do it.
I believe so. Because we're talking about the falsity of the representations that factually cause the damage. Is it a stronger case? Is it more palatable to have reliance that someone heard it and acted upon it and put it in? Of course. It's logical, as justices have already indicated. But it is not an element of a DPPA case because the object of the act is to provide an efficient and economical procedure to protect consumers from false, misleading, and deceptive acts.
Counsel, how would the misrepresentation be the producing cause of the damages if the damages would occur even if there had been no misrepresentation?
Well, in this case, there were representations, and there would be representations made.
But if the damages would occur independently, in other words, the plumbing would still be bad, even if there had been no misrepresentations, how can there be misrepresentation be the producing cause of those damages?
Well, if there's no representation, one wouldn't have a DTPA case because it would require at least a representation or unconscionability or some other element of the DTPA. You need, obviously, the several prongs. You need consumer status, an actionable violation of the act, and producing cause of damage. So, again, you would need that representation. What we're discussing here, it seems to me, is must the consumer hear it, rely upon it? If you impose that requirement, is it logical to assume that people such as a manufacturer, a supplier, or a distributor of the product will be in the sales home of General Homes or any other builder at the time the purchaser comes in? Aren't you really injecting a requirement of privity? Aren't you really saying that purchaser walks into that sales home to buy his home? if the manufacturer's not sitting across the table and the supplier and the distributor, so he can ask them about the component parts, they have no cause of action against those parties for their false misleading act.
If we agreed with the petitioners in this case, would your clients be deprived of a DTPA cause of action against their immediate seller?
Not against General Homes, but against Ewing and Rath, who sold, manufactured, designed, tested the system. When this system was failing, when Shell was having its own internal correspondence refer to these fittings as the acetyl albatross.
So we're talking about a DTPA cause of action in addition to the one that you say already exists against the immediate seller.
I'm saying the cause of action exists today under this court's authority and under statute to Shell, to U.S. Brass, to Celanese. The suggestion that...
And against the immediate seller.
And the immediate seller. To suggest that this is an unprecedented expansion of the law is totally incorrect. It is just the opposite. You are applying well-established, firmly embedded authority that the two requirements for consumer status must be met. They are met. That producing cause does not include reliance. Producing cause was proved in this record by the fact that this representations about the suitability of this system was what caused the damage in this case. And the damages obviously have been established through this evidence.
Counsel,
a consumer case has been established.
In the Andros case, why aren't many of the plaintiff's cases barred by the statute of limitations for the failure of the plaintiffs to secure a finding that the discovery rule was out?
As the Court of Appeals found, Shell took, and as well as the other defendants, secured the burden on that particular issue. And the findings of the jury with respect to that support the finding that they did not discover, nor should have discovered, the defect that was in their plumbing system before 2 years filing suit. And, of course...
Well, was it not your burden to secure a jury finding?
It would have been our burden under Woods v. Mercer, but that was a burden that was assumed by the defendants due to the state of the law at the time and some confusion concerning the submission of that issue. But it was a burden that was assumed by the defendants under this record and found to support a finding that there was, in fact, no discovery and that they should not have reasonably discovered those defects. I would merely say that I understand that under the current law as it exists, there has been some desire to look at the entirety of the transaction. If the court does that, looks at the entirety of this transaction, the evidence is overwhelming that each of these defendants sought to enjoy the benefits of this transaction. Each of these defendants played an integral part in ensuring that this product reached the stream of commerce. Any attempt to engraft a requirement that this Supreme Court has never recognized and that is cited nowhere in the statute. Maybe the question that should be posed on rebuttal is simple. Where in the statute can you find and point to me are the famous words in connection with? They're not.
You talked about Cameron versus Garrett. You have not talked about Knight and Chastain versus Coons and Homestead versus Garrett.
Correct.
Which do have some language in connection with them.
You will find as you read those decisions, and I'll ask the court to read them and see the context in which those words were used. They were used in a generic description of what the intent of the act was. When they got to the holding of the case does not support this interpretation. The holding of the case was privity or a similar requirement is not necessary. The holding of the case was only two requirements are necessary. The holding of the case is public policy demands a liberal construction of the act. And there is no case, with the exception of this Taylor versus Burke case that's out of the Court of Appeals in Amarillo, has anyone ever latched on to the in connection with language
In connection with what was in the statute, would you lose this case?
It was not in the statute, Judge.
If the statute were written and included in connection with, would you lose?
I don't think we would lose. I think there'd be a question of what in connection with means. And I would say that in connection with means that the complaint must relate to the goods. In connection with is simply a discussion of the fact that the second prong must be satisfied. That it makes no sense to impose liability against a defendant who is innocent, who has no involvement with the entirety of the transaction. But we don't have that factual pattern here. We have defendants who were found culpable, who knew their product was defective, and was sold on in the marketplace in a defective condition. And the question is, do we fashion a rule of law heretofore never adopted by a court in order to allow them to escape liability?
The question is not, I take it from your earlier answer, whether your clients recover under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. The question is against whom they recover.
Correct. And I would say that the consumer defines the class of persons who can be sued. We satisfy that test, and we are consumers. You've been asked to interject this in connection with requirement, and that, of course, is nowhere found in the statute.
It looks to me as if you lose that argument. If consumer defines who can be sued, their argument is, well, you may be a consumer as to somebody, but you're not a consumer as to me. What's the response to that?
Yeah. Consumer defines a class of persons who can sue. This court has interpreted through case law the situation of which defendants can be held liable. And those holdings turn on the involvement of the defendant between themselves, not with the consumer. Inextricably intertwined, tie-in, Knight, Flanagan, Quantel in 1988, all turned on the fact that the relationship between the defendants with respect to the goods were such that liability should be imposed. And in here, in our case, the relationship between the defendants is inextricably intertwined. They are each in an integral part of why this product got into this home, an integral part of why there was damage caused to these homeowners.
In your view, Shell and Celanese did not just sell raw materials. They were involved in the development of the product?
Yes. I would say it was just not my view, Your Honor. I would say this record is abundantly clear. Mark, if you'd place that exhibit. I have a copy of this exhibit before you. You will see with respect to each element in this case, design, manufacture, testing, sales and marketing, failure analysis, concealment, knowledge of the defect. Each one of the defendants has been found in those categories by evidence in this record to have been involved. So this is not, as they suggest to you, the case of an innocent supplier who put a product out into the marketplace. They helped design the system. They tested the system. I'm speaking of Celanese.
Well,
they helped with the design.
According to your view of how this applies, it doesn't matter whether they're innocent or not. If they are a supplier of a product, raw material that goes into a product, parts that go into a product, and that part or raw material or supply fails, they're not innocent.
Well, by definition, they're not innocent. If they produce a defective product.
It's really not relevant that they designed or manufactured. The only relevance is that they put this product in the stream of commerce, and that product ultimately ended up being purchased by the homeowners, and that product failed.
And that
satisfies every element of the DTPA.
Well, I think you need to satisfy all three elements, consumer status, a representation, and producing cost.
Well, of course, as a person who's building a product, I wouldn't put a part in there that was not represented to me that would do the work that it was designed to do.
Correct.
Right.
Right. And this act was designed to protect consumers so that people who do produce defective products make false, misleading, deceptive acts, act unconscionably, are held responsible under the full breadth of the act. Correct.
What's, in any of these suits, was there ever a pleading in strict liability in tort?
Yes. At one point in time, the strict liability was not submitted to the jury. There are other concerns in submission with regard to strict liability, given the nature of the case, and it was not submitted. The only issues submitted were negligence and DTPA.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, Mr. William Powers, Jr., on behalf of the United States Brass Corporation, will present a rebuttal for petitioners. We will speak for 10 minutes.
Thank you. May I please the court? Mr. O'Brien asked me a question for rebuttal, and I'll take him up on that question. He says, where in the statute is the in connection with language that this court, as Ms. Yates demonstrated, this court has recognized on several occasions and several opinions, where is that in the statute? As though we're asking the court to rewrite the statute. Well, I represent clients who don't think the court ought to rewrite statutes, and I'd like to answer that question. In Flanagan, this court pointed something out about the statute, and that is it defines who the plaintiffs are who can sue, but it is silent on the question of what kinds of defendants on what kinds of theories can be sued. It's silent how far up the chain of distribution the DTPA goes. When the statute is silent on something, this court has no option but to fill in that gap. It simply can't leave the gap unwritten on. In fact, the plaintiffs and the Court of Appeals in this case relied on the inextricably intertwined language. Inextricably intertwined tells us when a defendant can be sued. I'd ask the plaintiffs where the inextricably intertwined language is in the statute. It's not anywhere in the statute. The reason is the statute is silent on this point. And the court has to come up with a workable rule, and it has come up with a workable rule in connection with the transaction that makes the plaintiff a consumer. So that's not asking the court to rewrite the statute. The second thing in response to Mr. O'Brien's argument is he's made his position perfectly clear. All they have to show, according to their theory, is that there's a misrepresentation and cause and effect. That's all they have to show. That's an unworkable rule that is not going to give any guidance to trial courts. It's not going to give any guidance to courts of appeals in dealing with these cases. And let's go through some of the examples. Some of them have come out in the discussion and the questions thus up till now. We could go under their theory all the way back to Mobil. If when Mobil was selling its polybutylene business, it made any representation about polybutylene employment, their clients would have a cause of action under the DTPA, not just a product liability cause of action, but under the DTPA, under their theory, against Mobil. The vacuum cleaner distributor, under their theory, there would be a cause of action against the distributor or against the manufacturer dealing with the distributor simply as to whether the distributor was going to carry their product. If we hadn't had these misrepresentations, we wouldn't have carried this product. This plaintiff would not have purchased it. Misrepresentation and cause and effect. In fact, it's going to be even broader than that. If I sell batteries, and I'm selling 100,000 batteries to Ford to put in their automobiles, I'm going to say they're good batteries. These are good for automobiles. One of them doesn't work. And this representation isn't passed along to the consumer, but one of these batteries doesn't work. Because of that, the consumer doesn't go out of town on an out-of-town trip. Stays in town and gets mugged, gets shot. There's a misrepresentation. There's cause and fact. The test they are asking the trial courts to apply is that there would be liability in that case. Now, I'm not suggesting they think there would be liability in that case. That's an extreme example. But the test they're proposing, if they say just look at the language of the statute, the test they're proposing would permit liability in that situation. And the court has to develop a workable test. In fact, the court has developed a workable test that the misrepresentation has to be in connection, connected to the transaction that made the plaintiff a consumer. That is a workable test, the test they're suggesting.
They say they meet that test. The plumbing failed. sold, they're suing, they were homeowners were damaged.
Correct. And in fact,
so it is in connection with the transaction.
Well, but if the only thing that makes it in connection with, under their test, is cause and fact, and if their definition of in connection with is cause and fact, then every one of these examples, there's going to be cause and fact. And so under that test, in every one of these examples, they would be in connection
with. Counsel, you use the term cause and fact or producing cause.
Well, they've used both the term producing cause and cause and fact. And they're not adding anything in their argument. I don't think producing cause means cause and fact, but under their theory, their argument is that producing cause means cause and fact. But for, that's all they've argued, but for some representation up the chain, this would have never ended up in the plaintiff's home. That's the test of causation they're using. And that test is going to go all the way back up the chain, and it's going to create liability in all of these other examples that we've been through, which I think we can all agree there ought not be liability, but their test is not going to give any guidance to the trial courts and the courts of appeals. Whereas the in connection with test, this court has recognized, does give the trial courts and courts of appeals. In other words, they can look at the transaction here and say, whatever representations we made, to whomever we made them, it wasn't in connection with the purchase of the home from General Homes. I think that's a workable, relatively bright line test that the courts of appeals and the trial courts can deal with. Now, in fact, in Andrus, where we're the only party, they actually make a more extreme argument. In the Andrus case, the representations were made not to anybody who had anything to do with the plaintiff's home. Not to the home builders, not to anybody else. It had nothing to do with the fact that the plumbing was in the plaintiff's home. And yet they still argue there's producing cause. Why? Because if the plumbing had lived up to the representation, the plumbing would have still been there. It still would have been defective. But if it had lived up to the representation, then the damage would not have occurred. Well, that's just writing even causing fact or producing cause out of the cause of action. That argument was directly considered in McKnight versus Hill and Hill Exterminator and was rejected by this court. So the argument they're making in Andrus, this court's already dealt with. If there was a representation by the exterminator, this is termite-free house. The house was not termite-free, so it didn't live up to the representations. And the court said, no, that's not the causal link that the plaintiff has to show against the exterminators. The plaintiff has to show that but for the statement, but for the representation, the damage would have occurred. And the court said there was no proof of that, and therefore just the fact that the product doesn't live up to the representation is not enough, even under the but-for test of causation. But come back to the Andrus case and the Cochi case. Even the but-for test of causation is not going to give the trial courts and the courts of appeals guidance as to why there would not be liability against Mobil, why there would not be liability in the battery case where somebody gets mugged, where there would not be liability in the situation with the vacuum cleaner distributor. I'd like to make just one point on the res judicata issue, which Mr. O'Brien raised, and the privity issue. In many of these cases, the plaintiffs are suing after somebody else has already recovered repair and replacement damages for that plumbing. And a new plaintiff buys the house and wants to recover again. The standard rule of res judicata is that successors entitled to property are bound by the previous litigation. And the only argument the Court of Appeals and the plaintiffs make against that is these are new damages, new leaks. Well, in fact, every bit of damage in these successor lawsuits was recoverable in the previous lawsuit. Repair and replacement, which would have taken care of the entire problem, was recoverable in the previous lawsuit. So the plaintiffs are not asking in the successor, in the second lawsuit, for any new damage. And in fact, if repair and replacement had not taken care of the damages, the plaintiffs in the original lawsuit still could have recovered for lost or diminished market value. That's just a present cash value reduction of future problems with the property. That's just like recovering future medical bills reduced to present cash value in a personal injury case. So all of these damages, either under repair or replacement or diminished market value, were recoverable in the original lawsuit, the successors entitled, are entitled to that property, are privy, and res judicata ought to apply. By the way, in response to the Chief Justice's question, that same point ought to be dispositive of the statute of limitations issues as well, but the court did not grant the writ on that.
Well, would you speak to the statute of limitations just a minute? Because when we get a case, we have to consider all the points that might affect the judgment, whether we have specifically pointed the amount in a grant or not.
Well, the plaintiff's position on the statute of limitations point and the Court of Appeal is that since the original purchaser might have known or been on notice of the defect in the fund and the damage, they would have been barred by the statute of limitations. But the successor purchasers, so the argument went, had not yet discovered the plumbing. They weren't told about it during the sale, or they sued within 2 years after they purchased the property. So the argument was that they were not barred by the statute of limitations. Now again, the general rule in statute of limitations is that successors entitled to property are privies and therefore step into the shoes of the predecessor for res judicata purposes, as I've argued, but also for statute of limitations.
Are you saying this would be if we agree with that legal theory, this is established as a matter of law on the record so that we don't have to get into question 36 and whether it was properly.
That's correct. Now, I want to be clear. I have not gone back to the factual record on each statute of limitation problem as to whether the predecessor, whether there's a fact question on whether the predecessor had discovered or should have discovered the injury. But if the predecessor had discovered or should have discovered the injury, then as a matter of law, then the successor should be barred as a privy. And if that were not the rule, if somebody had problems with their plumbing, and they find out they're barred by the statute of limitations, under their theory that the successor entitled is not a privy, all they'd have to do is sell the property. Even sell the property with notice of the problem in the plumbing. Because the new purchaser, under their theory, would still have 2 years to sue. So that in any homeowner case, a plaintiff could always avoid the statute of limitations just by going through a sale, and a new statute of limitations would start. We could have litigation going all the way back to mobile and going all the way down to repurchasers of these houses forever, never barred by statute of limitations, never barred by res judicata. That's the theory they're trying to sell to this court.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in these causes, and the court. These causes will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay.